So I'm very pleased to introduce now Judith Liu. She is Lady Margaret's Professor of Divinity at Cambridge University and the current SNTS President. She is the author of numerous works as Christian Identity in the Jewish and Greco-Roman World, published in 2004. And she is very much interested in the second century and its relevance for the development of early Christianity, and has recently published a study of the eresiological construction of Martian with the title Martian and the Making of a Heretic. The title of Professor Liu's lecture now is on strategies in constructing networks of knowledge. And so, please.
I'm afraid I've got no pictures for you. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's for me, I spent 3 months here earlier on this year in Berlin, so it's wonderful to have the excuse to come back again. One of the disadvantages of coming both towards the end of the day when you're all falling asleep, but also at the end of such a wonderful feast of papers, is that I find myself scribbling down the margins of my paper as I rethink how I'm going to start it. So I'm not quite sure how that will work. My title is Strategies in Constructing Networks of Knowledge. Among the so-called agreed results of much recent research on emergent Christianity has been the emphasis on its diversity, as well as on how firmly it was embedded in contemporary and local culture, intellectually, in literary ways, as we've seen in terms of various social practices. Now, this insight might seem to lie in tension with a contemporaneous energetic investigation of the intentional construction of a highly differentiated Christian identity, both generally and in relation to specific texts. To speak of construction highlights that defining an identity challenges the perhaps continuing threat of sameness, i.e. of appearing not to be different after all, and also that any identity may be experienced differently from within than from without. Yet the visibility of Christians as possessed of recognisable identifying marks is testified by the oft-cited comments of Tacitus and Suetonius regarding Christians in Neronic Rome, and by Pliny and by subsequent, albeit debated, incidences of persecution and so on. And examples such as these are regularly used against the widely adopted position, for example, that the so-called parting of the ways was an extended and gradual process, in some contexts not complete until the 4th century, i.e. that Jews and Christians were not differentiated. And such examples might also be used against theories that treat Christian communities as largely indistinguishable from other city-based voluntary associations. Now, I think what some of our papers today have shown is how a project such as ECAM further complicates this tension between embeddedness and differentiation. Even when identified, Christian inscriptions when identifiable Christian inscriptions appear, they often replicate local values, while for the earliest period they are invisible, which does not mean that they did not exist. Rather, that invisibility challenges us to ask how Christian identity was experienced and disseminated alongside the other identities that people experienced and which in some contexts were more dominant for them. I.e., we need a model. We need models that respect this continuing embeddedness, not as a sign, as one might think of Ramsay MacMullen's Second Church or older views about demi-Christians, but as a social reality which existed alongside clearer identity construction. Now, I have to admit, for me, from my scholarly perception, this is a particularly pressing issue because I'm one of those people who tend to read my literary texts with a high degree of scepticism and to tend to see them much more as affecting construction than as reflecting actual social realities or real communities. So how are we to proceed towards a description of Christianity, both at the local level and more widely, particularly in the early period? And in asking that, I'm confessing that despite my tendency to talk about construction, I am disinclined to surrender using the term Christianity, even in the second century, and even if I always put inverted commas around it. Obviously, we can no longer use models of a unified, expanding institution directed from the centre, such as might have been implied by Matthew 28:19. We are not thinking of a sort of Starbucks consciously moving into new areas and increasing the number of branches, all bearing the same logo or franchise. Models of conscious or implicit directional control do not match the evidence. At the same time, accounts that rely purely on the local and seek to identify institutions and structures, such as forms of ministry or patterns of belief, particularly in some attempt to trace some sort of continuity, equally rely on presuppositions about definition and about what counts as significant. So, for example, older attempts to trace Christianity at Antioch through Matthew, Ignatius, and John Chrysostom implied leaping huge gaps and having selective amnesia. And simply, questions as to whether or not Papias was marginal or central for the region around Hierapolis may depend on how far you are trying to create a single narrative. At another extreme, models such as that adopted by Rodney Stark that describe Christianity as expanding along existing networks of relationships like an epidemic, which need no explanation, are equally driven by functionalist presuppositions and tend to rely on theoretical models, general principles, and estimations such as of demographics and lack groundings in the specifics of survivals. Yet despite the weakness of Stark's analysis, attention to networks, both as a theoretical model and as actually constituted in the Greco-Roman world, does offer an approach to describing the dynamics of early Christianity. The actual processes by which individuals or family groups were persuaded to allegiance to Christ, and by which communities of such individuals and groups were formed, as well as the dynamics between those moments, are probably not recoverable. And in any case, they are likely to have taken a number of forms. Yet at a very simple level, thinking in terms of networks and acknowledging that people may participate in more than one network at any given time has a number of advantages. It can avoid the difficulties created by imagining that reified constructs, such as the binary oppositions Christianity versus Judaism, orthodoxy versus heresy, actually replicated any realities on the ground at all. It can acknowledge the apparently blurred boundaries in some contexts between those who are labelled in the literary polemical sources as Marcionites, Valentinians, so-called Catholics, and others. And attention to networks also allows us to explore the local alongside the regional and the so-called global. To adopt a related model, and I'm thinking here of Irad Malkin's work on Hellenization, it may help us to conceptualize how such links of different kinds produced a so-called small world rather than proto-orthodoxy. At a more sophisticated level, network theory has begun to be used fruitfully, both in analysing the link between archaic Greek communities, but also in analysing the spread of religions, and I think of Anna Koller's work on Jupiter Doricanus, and I think less successfully on diaspora Judaism, and also in mapping the power relations within Christianity of the 4th century and later, for example, through the letters of Basil or Theodoret, whose correspondence runs into volumes. For the 1st and 2nd centuries, comparable possibilities are limited, precisely because of the ambiguity and the sparsity of our extant evidence, and the likely loss of far more than what survives. For the same reason, I think it is difficult to know how much progress can be made by tracing the movement of texts, although that does not mean we should not do it. Matthew and Luke must, according to the consensus, have received Mark. The author of Ephesians, some of Paul's letters, Ignatius likewise, and as we've already heard this afternoon, Irenaeus' Adversus Hieresis reaches Egypt surprisingly early. Yet how and through whom these texts travelled remains obscure. However, the area that is of particular interest for me is that of networks of knowledge. Rather than assume that knowledge is transmitted, usually downwards, through established hierarchies and institutional structures, even if those hierarchies and structures have the task of controlling or disseminating knowledge, recent study of networks of knowledge pays careful attention to the actual mechanisms by which knowledge is transmitted and by which innovation takes place, both within institutions and among those with shared interests. And if you wonder what I might be meaning, it would have been possible for your conference packs to have told you precisely what restaurants there were in the region and which you ought to go to for your lunch. But more probably, you would have turned to somebody who knew Berlin and said, what would you recommend? I.e., the way knowledge is actually transmitted is not how it is supposed to be transmitted. For example, it might help identify individuals who serve as knowledge promoters, while also tracing the informal routes along which knowledge is passed, and observing that the transmission of knowledge does not move in one direction, from teacher to taught, but invariably involves exchange, adaption, and hence innovation. This is a model that has received much attention recently, largely because it is commercially highly useful in our so-called knowledge society. But it has also proved fruitful in analysis of the past, and particularly at times of social and intellectual change. To speak of networks of knowledge in this context suggests that Christian allegiance can be understood as involving a new and distinctive form of knowledge. Such knowledge would include worldview, ideas of salvation, ethics, sources that are considered authoritative and their interpretation. But it should also include ritual knowledge and therefore ritual practice. And I'd want to emphasise that not everybody has to have the whole package all the time at the same time, but that you get specialists in different forms of knowledge, etc., and that they can be passed, etc., in different ways and through different networks. Thus, to speak of knowledge need not be to privilege the educated elite or the intellectual aspects of Christianity. Inevitably, there will be different levels and modes of participation in or investment in this knowledge, different ways of configuring it, different subfields of expertise or contribution to development and change. It may also be articulated and expressed in different ways and contexts. Ritual knowledge will be exchanged in different ways than exegetical knowledge. Lifestyle may move independently of them both. However, in what follows, I do want to focus on early Christian literature within this framework. The pairing of this paper with Laura Nasrallah's, which I really enjoyed and pairs even better than the title might have said, despite the generality of my title, probably reflects the organiser's awareness of my current preoccupation with letters. And inasmuch as network analysis is interested not just in who is connected to whom, but in the nature and the intensity of the flow, or actual movements between them, it is particularly applicable to the exchange of letters. While the exchange of letters has indeed played a central role in the study of innovations in knowledge in more recent periods of history. In a paper given earlier this summer, I argued for the importance of the letter format, whether real or imagined, for the emergence or creation of a Christian social world or symbolic universe. There I drew attention to the way that letters serve to shape and reconfigure space at various levels, in the imagination, if not in actuality. Without repeating that paper here, I want to explore further the different levels on which we may locate letters as having a major strategic function in constructing networks of knowledge. In the present context, the concentration of association of early Christian letters with Asia Minor makes them particularly appropriate for inclusion within this project. They include, of course, a number of the Paulines, 1 Peter, the letters of the Apocalypse, 6 of the Ignatian letters, those associated with Polycarp, and others besides, between which there are multiple and often conflicting lines of connection. Many of the growing number of studies of local churches within the region have, of course, made extensive use of these letters for the early period. However, I think they have tended to use them as sources of information for the names of key individuals, for developments in structures, for styles of theology, including that promulgated by opponents. That is not entirely inappropriate, although I think there are serious questions that can be asked, as, for example, in the familiar debate as to whether Ignatius' letters reflect the situation in Syrian Antioch or in the churches to which he writes, or as in the problems of mirror reading Galatians or 1 John. Moreover, I fear that this approach can engender a slightly naive historicism or a repeated counsel of despairing ignorance. However, my interest is in the letters as letters. Letters are not merely carriers of information, they actively participate in the effect that they produce. I have suggested that perhaps even more than the gospel, letters occupy a primary place within the distinctive literary creativity that helps constitute early Christianity. Although to claim that is not to deny the multiple ways in which early Christian letters are rooted in and are part of the epistolary culture of the ancient world. Nonetheless, letter writing becomes characteristic of and constitutive of the operation of early Christianity, and particularly of the exercise of power and authority. This is self-evidently the case from the 3rd and even more from the 4th century onwards in the voluminous episcopal correspondence. But its roots are to be traced much earlier. As a first step, we might want to direct our attention to the actual flow of letters or the other forms of connectedness that lie behind them. Through letter carriers, exchange of correspondence, gifts of text that accompanied them. In a further step, we might want to map the nodes, to use network language, from which significant links radiate, or the knowledge promoters, who, regardless of any ecclesial role, disseminate knowledge of particular kinds or act as points of exchange. No less important might be the gaps, those apparently excluded from any or from specific networks, or even evidence of competition, although here the lacunae in our evidence makes this particularly hazardous. Yet all this is more easily said than done. The instructions to the Colossians to exchange both greetings and letters with the Church of the Laodiceans are repeatedly cited as evidence of networking among Pauline communities. But the significance of this is complicated, both by the lack of the clarity as to the import of the actual Greek, tein ek Laodiceus, and by the arguable pseudonymity of Colossians. Pseudonymity demands the possibility that the totality of the epistolary situation is fictitious, and therefore that such instructions presumably serve a rhetorical function within the letter and may or may not betray any contemporary realities. The possibility that in some circles the letter now known as Ephesians was received as addressed to Laodicea itself reflects different representations of relationship and proximity. An even more complex pattern surrounds Polycarp of Smyrna. He is, first, the recipient of a letter from Ignatius, purportedly sent from Troas, or perhaps from Neapolis. People tend to assume Troas because that's what Eusebius says, but actually if you read the letter, it is far from clear. In this letter, he is requested to write to the churches that lie ahead, whatever that might mean, and to set in motion a cascade of further letters. Secondly, he is the author of a, or perhaps of more than one letter, directed outside the province to Philippi, which itself presupposes receipt of an earlier letter from Philippi itself. And this, in turn, may also testify to the origins of an Ignatian collection, whether or both at Smyrna and Philippi. Thirdly, Polycarp is the primary subject of a further letter sent from the church at Smyrna, which contains the account of the persecution and martyrdom there, but which implicates others from Philadelphia, but which is sent to the Phrygian church of Philomelium, apparently in reply to a request from there, but which is also directed to all the sojournings of the Holy Catholic Church in every place, if indeed that language is original to the text. And yet, that letter from the Church of Smyrna betrays no certain direct contact with Ignatius. On the surface, we might produce from these elements a suggestive map of strong and weak links. And I suppose I could, if I'd had time, try to map them on a map of Asia Minor. Although we would have to discuss whether the nodal point here is the person, Polycarp, the position he holds, which is unclear, was he or was he not a bishop, is he important because he's a martyr, or the city which claimed him, Smyrna. To these various lines of connectedness, we might add the reference to Polycarp and his letters to neighbouring churches or certain of the believers, which is made in Irenaeus's letter to Florinus, as reported by Eusebius. And for these purposes, as for all this, of course, the fact that Florinus is supposed to be a heretic is totally immaterial, because networks ignore such categories which are later imposed on history. Indeed, even if one function of letters is to try and establish such categories. Now, often this Polycarp material has been discussed in terms of the history of tradition, perhaps from a certain John, whoever that might have been, through to Irenaeus via Polycarp. We might want instead to focus our attention on the function of letters within this network, letters that are cited or letters that are only reported, in thus creating and moderating a network between individuals, but also between places. But such a network would also have to include the disrupted lines, such as, for example, the lack of direct Ignatian reference in the letter from Smyrna, and even more in Irenaeus's curious but anonymous reference to Ignatius's letter to the Romans. However, while this could be plotted on an interesting or to create an interesting map, there are problems. Not only the unity, but also the authenticity of Polycarp's letter or parts of it are contested, and with it, the origins of the Ignatian collection, to which I shall return. Perhaps more important, the letter from Smyrna about Polycarp's martyrdom survives within two major traditions. One, as an independent martyrdom account, although also having a disputed relationship with other related Polycarpiana, i.e. the later life of Polycarp and the martyrdom of Paionios. The other, embedded within Eusebius's history of the church, behind which it seems to have had an earlier existence in Eusebius's own collection of martyr accounts, which no longer survives. Thus, whatever its origins, the letter from Smyrna has lost its epistolary context and is embedded in other rhetorical contexts which have come to colour the way it was transmitted and the way it is therefore read. There are significant differences between the versions in the separate martyrdom tradition and the Eusebian tradition, which have been variously explained. Furthermore, the traditions in other language versions, including the Armenian, produce a yet more complex pattern of variation, which has led one recent edition to propose a much heavier and more extended period of redaction than the classic solutions have envisaged. Even apart from this, it is evident that Eusebius has located the account within a particular rhetorical context, drawing it from earlier settings, including, as I've said, a collection of its own, where it would have had different functions. This then means, that we have to move from mapping specific network relations to constructing a map or subsequent maps of imagining and reconfiguring networks through subsequent redaction and citation of the text. And we do well to be aware of Eusebius's deliberate use of the letter. Much of our general knowledge of the exchange of letters in the early church, beyond those that survive independently, comes from his account of the period. Eusebius regularly refers to and even gives brief quotations from letters that he passed to and fro, that he says passed to and fro. For example, the letters of Dionysius of Corinth, which Eusebius dubs Catholic, and which for our purposes include letters to the Nicomedians and to the churches in Pontus. Yet it has been argued recently that this is a deliberate rhetorical strategy by Eusebius, based probably on limited evidence, and that we need to read it closely to detect where the picture he paints is justified by the examples he cites. And even then, we must approach those examples with a healthy dose of scepticism. Perhaps the best example of the possibilities and the problems, however, is posed by the letters associated with Ignatius, to which I have already referred. According to the so-called middle recension, usually considered the earliest recoverable version, Ignatius wrote letters to six churches, five in Asia Minor and one to Polycarp, possibly head of one of those churches, i.e. at Smyrna. Three of these he wrote while in Smyrna, two, or perhaps three, depending on where you locate the Polycarp's letter, from Troas. Ignatius is represented as a prisoner being taken under guard to Rome to face the beasts, although the details of the situation are perplexing. He visits two of the cities to which he writes, Smyrna and Philadelphia, but he is visited at the former by delegates of other churches from Ephesus, Magnesia, and Tralles. He thus creates a network, both by his letters and the conventional exchange of greetings, but also by his own person, since these delegates come intentionally to visit him. Although there are only hints whether the network might be more extensive than these five churches, either in practice or in aspiration. However, the network does also extend beyond Asia Minor to Rome through a further letter, also written from Smyrna, through the Ephesians, whatever that might mean, and also back to Antioch, from which Ignatius has come, through messengers, and in the case of Smyrna, through a letter that he asked the church to send there. Although it's not clear why he wants the people at Smyrna to send a letter along with messengers. As is well known, the common themes of the letters cluster around the physical reality of Jesus' human experience, the trifold structure of the church around bishops, presbyters, and deacons, the necessity of meeting together, and the crucial role of Ignatius' own coming death. Regardless of any external historical pretext, these themes constitute a certain form of knowledge, although in so saying, we needn't assume that they bear any reality, any relationship to any reality outside his letters. However, the scenario envisaged has prompted some scepticism. What degree of freedom was Ignatius given? How much time did the toing and froing take? How did the churches hear of his impending or actual arrival in Smyrna? And why did they send delegates to visit him? Are we therefore to assume patterns of relationship prior to his visit to the region? And if so, what was the basis of these? At the same time, the letters achieve their effect as a collection, not least because it is the collection that achieves the repetition of the core themes and the degree of internal cross-authentication. It is as a collection that the letters tell us that story of Ignatius, forced to travel through Asia Minor and Greece, but claiming for himself the space through which he travels. It is as the letter as a collection that we see Ignatius's frog march become a triumphal, quasi-religious procession, marking particular points and anticipating a climax in the capital city. And yet, anticipating that climax, he writes in an unmistakably subversive manner to the church there, which is provocatively described as presiding in the place of the land of the Romans. Again, a quotation that is too often used to debate questions of church authority and not within the rhetoric of the letter itself. He writes to them, "Neither the corners of the universe nor the kingdoms of this age are of any benefit to me." Read together in this way, as Katharina Waldner has shown, these letters redefine the space on which they are mapped, no longer as part of the map of the Roman Empire, but as one claimed for the Church of God. And it is striking that in his prescripts, Ignatius does not use the imagery familiar from 1 Peter and the Polycarp tradition, and taken up by later churches, of sojourning. The churches to whom Ignatius writes are unabashedly in Philadelphia of Asia. This collective image-creating effect is the source of the continuing debate as to whether or not, or in what sense, these are genuine letters. And I have to admit myself still in a state of agnosticism as to in what sense these are genuine letters, but certainly as a collection, they become something, as we've already heard, like an epistolary novel, simply by the very fact of their being collected and divorced from specific epistolary contexts. And I am prepared to remain uncertain as to what relationship they might therefore have with an actual Syrian Christian by the name of Ignatius. Are they, or to what extent are they, a sort of fictional novel through letters? And if so, to what purpose, and why through letters? This was, as we have heard, an age when collections of letters developed as a genre in its own right. And all such collections, even those of a Cicero or a Seneca, had their own clear and carefully manipulated potential for experimentation and for reconstruction of the author or of the recipients and their story. As we have seen, any collection of letters, by definition, dissolves the bond between the individual letter and the separate specific places inhabited by the author and the recipients, thus making it possible to read them as a narrative either of external events or of the author's or recipient's personal journey. Thus, although we may distinguish between collections of genuine letters, such as those of Pliny, and fictional letters, such as the spurious letters of Apollonius or the letters of fishermen, both tell a story which could be consciously manipulated. Locating Ignatius's letters in this setting would not mean that they do not constitute a strategy in constructing knowledge, but would demand rethinking how they so functioned and in what circumstances. So in this paper, I have only explored some of the possibilities and problems of studying the rhetorical effects of early Christian letters as transmitted in different frameworks, both social ones and in the creation of a memory. And while I appreciate that this is not the main concern of the Topoi database and of ECAM, I would suggest that it is a necessary partner to it, raising the possibilities of asking new questions about the way we trace the story of the past. Thank you.